It's a wonderful place for an orchard, but a terrible place for growing fruit. In central England, far from the buffering effect of the sea, the trees are blighted by late frosts. Freezing air flows like water, but here on this flat plot, dammed by rows of houses, it gathers and pools, drowning the orchard in cold. Every year, as the trees come into blossom, my hopes crack open with the breaking buds. Roughly 2 years out of three, they wither with the flowers. Frost curls into the branches like poison gas, shriveling and blackening the stamens. By autumn, the orchard is a living graph of spring temperatures. Apple varieties blossom at different but regular dates. Unless a freeze is especially hard, it damages only the open flower. From the trees, with and without fruit, you can tell when the frost struck, almost to the night. Every variety belongs to the same species, Malus domestica, which translates literally as tamed evil. The reasons for the age-old defamation of a lovely tree are complex, but one is likely to be etymological confusion. A dialect name for fruit, malon, appears to have slipped from Greek into Latin, where it was, so to speak, corrupted into malum, or evil. This single species, too good to be true, has been bred into thousands of different forms. Dessert apples, cooking apples, cider apples, drying apples, in an astonishing range of sizes, shapes, colours, scents and flavours. We grow Miller's seedling, which ripens in August and must be eaten from the tree, as the slightest jolt in transit bruises its translucent skin. It's sweet and soft, more juice than flesh. By contrast, the Wiccan pippin, hard as wood when picked, is scarcely edible till January, then stays crisp until the following May. We grow St. Edmund's pippin, which has skin like sandpaper and is dry and nutty and aromatic for 2 weeks in September, after which it turns to fluff, and the golden russet, whose taste and texture are almost identical, but only in February. The Ashmead's kernel, crunchy with a hint of caraway, my favourite apple, peaks in midwinter. The Reverend W. Wilkes puffs up like wool when you bake it and tastes like a smooth white wine. The cat's head, roasted at Christmas, is almost indistinguishable from mango puree. Ribston pippin, Mannington's pearmain, Kingston black, Cottenham seedling, Darcy spice, Belderboss scoop, Ellis bitter, these fruit are capsules of time and place, culture and nature. As every tree requires subtly different conditions to prosper, some do better here than others. Some varieties are so finely adapted to their place of origin that they perform disappointingly on the other side of the same hill. By choosing breeds that blossom at different times, we've sought in this orchard to spread the risk. Even so, in bad years, when frost strikes repeatedly, we lose almost everything. But yes, despite the many broken dreams, it's a wonderful place for an orchard. When I arrived this morning, its beauty made me gasp. The first apple trees have come into flower, the pink buds uncurling to reveal their pale hearts. The pear and cherry trees are in full sail, carrying so much white blossom that their branches lift slightly in the breeze. I walk the rows of trees, smelling them. Every variety has a different, faint scent. Some of the blooms smell like hyacinth, some like lilac, some like daphne or viburnum. I believe I can tell when a flower has been pollinated. The perfume, no longer needed to attract bees and hoverflies, is immediately cut off. The pear blossom, pure white with 20 black stamens like tiny cloven hooves, stinks revoltingly of anchovies. The cherry petals are beginning to flake from the trees, drifting and feathering in the light wind. The new grass is streaked with shadow. Wood pigeons growl in the plum trees. To have all this within a few hundred metres of our home feels like an astonishing luxury, a luxury for which, between the five families who share it, we pay just £75 a year. The orchard occupies three adjoining plots on an allotment site. Since 1878 in England, local governments have allotted land for people to cultivate vegetables and fruit. In principle, since 1908, we've all had the legal right to grow. What this legislation inadvertently spread was anarchy, in its true sense. In other words, it created thousands of self-organized, self-governing communities, otherwise known as commons. Though the local government owns the land, it's managed and run by the people who work it. Our site in Oxford is divided into 220 plots, cultivated by people who have arrived in the city from all over the world. We cross-pollinate each other's knowledge with grains of peculiar experience. 17 years ago, the allotment seemed to be dying. Only 1/10 of the plots were occupied. The remnant community was desperate for people to take them on, otherwise the local authority would reclaim the site for housing. They leased me 2.5 adjoining plots, one of which was covered in monstrous brambles, snaking 3 metres into the air. I spent a month cutting the stems with a bush knife and hacking out the root balls with a mattock. Beneath them, Sleeping Beauty lay. Meadow grasses, cowslips, oxeye daisies, germander speedwell, vetch, knapweed, woodaven, scabious, yarrow, ribwort plantain, cat's ear and hawkbit sprang from the soil. The seeds must have lain dormant for decades. I persuaded a couple of friends to join me, and we planted the plots with heritage fruit trees, mostly apples with a few plums, cherries and pears, a medlar and a quince. Just as the trees became productive, I left Oxford and moved to Wales. Abandoning the orchard was among my few regrets. My friends passed it to others, who in turn passed it on. 5 years later, unexpectedly for family reasons, I returned. I didn't want to be back. But soon after I arrived, one of my best friends in the city told me that some people who had recently moved away had passed him a beautiful orchard, planted on the allotments a few years before. He couldn't manage it alone and remembered that I knew something about fruit trees. It felt like coming home.